Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast by Care Austria, with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to Care in Action, the podcast where we talk with people who are shaping the future of humanitarian work. Today, my guest is Ian Vail. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Andrea.
Good to have you here. Ian is the Chief Program Officer for CARE. He's a leader with decades of experience responding to some of the world's toughest crises. We'll talk about what it means to lead in times of change, how CARE is evolving to meet today's global challenges, and why localization and partnership are more important than ever. Ian, it's a pleasure to have you here in CARE in Action.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And let's get started. So I mentioned in the beginning that you have a long career in humanitarian work and development work. Can you start by telling us a bit around your journey and what first brought you to CARE?
Thanks. So my journey started a while ago now. I had a fantastic opportunity to go to Kosovo in 1998. I first went there in 1999. When our humanitarian sector was very different. The opportunity was to work for a medical organization running mobile clinics. It was in the midst of the conflict. Needless to say, it was a real insight, first hands-on experience. I remember the first day we went out into visit the program sites. We crossed the front lines of the conflict and saw all the realities that the communities were facing. I think what always struck me most about that was the commitment and resilience of the local teams. We were there as international staff to provide, support, oversight, to some extent, safety and security. But really, they very much led the work that we were doing, and it was their resolve to continue to develop to their communities that struck me the most.
Tell us a little bit about your career beginning. What did you study? How did you start? Was it in the humanitarian sector right from the beginning?
Yes, I studied international politics.
Okay.
Which always led me to an interest in what's happening in the world. So when I got the opportunity to volunteer, that was my first assignment in Kosovo as a volunteer. I have to say I probably jumped at the opportunity.
So you've never worked in the corporate sector?
I have not. I've worked, well, it's not true to say. I've had other jobs, but I wouldn't say a career.
I worked in
local government and the private sector.
I thought that we might have that in common because I have actually never worked in the private sector. I have worked only in two NGOs so far. So not from the beginning in the humanitarian sector, but this was your career path. This is where you felt that this is the place you want to be professionally.
Yes. Probably fair to say I had difficulty thinking about doing any job in the corporate sector or public sector.
Of course, I have to ask now why.
Yeah, because of it, I didn't have any interest in it. I had an interest in what was happening in the world and how those situations on the ground were in reality and how they evolved. And this was an age of intervention, really. Mm-hmm. There was a different global perspective because after Kosovo, I went to Sierra Leone, another global crisis at the time that where we saw global intervention bring some resolution to the situation. So it was a different age. But no, I was pretty clear all along that 9 to 5 wasn't really going to be sitting at a desk. Helping a company get richer wasn't going to really be my thing.
So we are sometimes also sitting at our desks, but not very often from 9 to 5, I have to admit. But when you look back, the things that you found important when you saw the situation in Kosovo, in Sierra Leone, this was also very conflict zones.
Yeah.
So what shocked you most or what motivated you most back then? Because we talk about nearly 30 years back.
Yeah, it's a long time ago. probably what I've referenced a little bit already. I was always most struck by the people that we worked for. I think there's always been a sense for me about the importance of action, of doing something, doing what you can do. So there's a real reality check about what's what's safe to do, what's right to do. You know, doing things according to our humanitarian principles, but always with a view to, well, okay, there's lots of problems that we could try and solve, but what is it where we can have the most impact? And this is obviously at a very local level originally. The difference you can make simply by arriving at a community or a village and providing some pretty basic healthcare or distributing some basic items and seeing what that means to the community and to the staff that you're doing it with. And the resolve that gives them and how they respect you that you have made the effort to go out there and do it with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember often there was, you know, why are you unloading the truck? It's like, because why wouldn't I help unload the truck?
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a volunteer, young volunteer at the time,
mm-hmm.
there's still a bit of that expectation that, you know, shouldn't you be doing something important on the computer or something?
So can one say that you were also driven by the wish to help?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I'm probably a bit of a compulsive helper. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, if you can help, why not?
yeah.
Let's do something. And I think that helping, that cutting through everything, is that if we can help, we should. And is very compelling for me. And then that probably evolved into the idea around change.
Mm-hmm.
So simply helping...
It's the initial spark, right?
It's the initial spark,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But then realizing what we're really trying to do is create change, whether that's short-term or long-term. And then how does that happen? How does change happen? It's probably part of the evolution of my interest in the sector.
So from help to change, one could say.
Yeah.
And do you think after the 30 years that we also have in common, I think I have been in the sector also for more than 30 years now, do you think that much change was achieved?
I think we always help, because we do it with the right intention and we do it according to, you know, a good sets of rules.
Mm-hmm. The humanitarian principles.
Yeah, humanitarian principles and our mm-hmm. internal rules. And we're very good at critiquing and challenging ourselves. So we're never really satisfied that we did enough or in the right way, could have done more, could have done it better. So I think that's quite healthy, though it can obviously, I think we, inside the sector, we realise that we can get a bit carried away with our own self-critique.
Mm-hmm.
But I think ultimately we've always helped. And then you can critique whether it was good enough and things like that. I think that's still the case. No, always, never enough, sometimes not fast enough. Can we be smarter about it? Always, for sure. But how much has changed? I mean, I think the sector that we're in, the organisations that we're in have obviously changed significantly. Fundamentally, when I think about it, what people need hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they still, if you're in an emergency situation, they still need protection, they still need safety, they still mm-hmm. need water and food.
As a matter of fact, the basic needs of people yeah. are bigger than ever, yeah. unfortunately.
Yeah.
We had some years where they were decreasing,
yeah.
but post-COVID and with all the conflicts that we have in the world, we have over 60 conflicts
right.
in the meantime, we see that the basic needs are increasing again.
Yeah.
And maybe you say for our listeners what the basic needs in humanitarian settings are that CARE is dealing with.
So we're still addressing water, clean water supply, basic hygiene, nutrition needs, basic health needs, food, access to food. So maybe directly to food supplies or through cash.
Shelter.
Yeah, so it's a multi-sectoral approach as much as possible, and increasingly through local partners as well.
So we see more and more protracted crises that forces us as organization to stay much longer, maybe than intended, when we look 20 years back. So the phasing out is happening less and less, I would say.
I think the idea that we might be able to phase out is less there, because even if you dealt with the short term emergency, there's often protracted crises, and we can see the longer term change required to address, you know, the rights of women and girls or the issues of different vulnerable communities. And then we're seeing the longer term developmental challenges of chronic poverty, extreme poverty, and the issues for vulnerable members of the community. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the things changes, that we often thought in a more linear way, things were bad, things will improve, we're beginning, we'll scale up, we'll scale out. And in actual fact, all of this is happening simultaneously in the same country.
So let's talk about care a little bit. In your introduction, I said that your working title is Chief Program Officer for Care. Mm-hmm. And in this function, you are based in Nairobi. So can you explain a little bit what you're doing in this function so that people from outside our organization and others understand what you do?
Sure. So my role is to oversee all our international programs. So that's in for care 44, 45 country offices. So that means we have different levels of programming, different scale of programming in different countries, whether it's Syria, whether it's Nigeria or Somalia or Bangladesh. We don't have one size fits all model of programming. So my job is to oversee that entire system and platform through five different regional offices and then into the country offices, and also to support our global humanitarian team, who will then support those country offices, respond to specific emergencies or disasters that occur.
What maybe outsiders don't know in detail is how it works when emergency hits. So it's not that people like you and me, you are based in Nairobi, but I would never go from Vienna to any emergency to help. How does that work when an emergency hits? How do we pool our staff resources to really take action quickly? Who are the first responders?
So the first responders are very often the communities themselves. But of course, they're also impacted by the emergency or the crisis. So we have to remember we don't work in isolation. There will be a local authority, a local government, there's local organizations, the community themselves. But in most cases where we're responding, we have an existing presence. We'll have a team running existing programs. And often those teams would have already thought and planned about potential emergencies and disasters. They'll know areas that are flood prone. They'll know those areas that are affected by drought or where there's potential for conflict. And they'd have prepared with partners, with the local government, with the communities to respond to those. So the immediate thing often that happens is, that team will be responding through its local planning and through its local partners with existing resources. That's in the very immediate. And then the advantage of an organization like CARE is that then we can mobilize globally. And then, of course, there are often in country, there are representatives of some donors who would also be working with their partners to respond.
Like the European Union, which is the most important donor to CARE Austria. And the second step, the global call for help and for donations, this is when our listeners of this podcast and our donors in Austria or Germany or wherever you listen to us come into play, right? So it's desperately needed that people take action when they see something bad on television, right?
Yes, the more immediate, the faster that we can get those resources to that team that's already responding on the ground. And that global coordination and the mobilization is where we're really adding our value through those resources that will get to the local teams and then providing additional support. It could be a very localized short-term emergency, but of course we're increasingly seeing longer-term chronic emergencies that require years of support and assistance.
And I'm really thankful that Ian explains how this works so in detail to our donors, because your support is desperately needed. Don't think CARE is such a big organization, they handle it anyhow. No, we are relying on your engagement, on your voice, and on your donation. And people like Ian and his team, they make sure that the money arrives where it is most needed, at the desk of the most vulnerable people in the world. Now, to all of us, it is unfortunately very well known that the funding for humanitarian support is shrinking globally. This is a phenomenon. It's not about the US, it's not about the European Union. This is a global phenomenon that we have to deal with. So how is CARE repositioning itself and dealing with the situation that more and more people are in need of humanitarian aid? If I have it in mind correctly, it's about 318 million that are desperately in need of humanitarian aid, in the sense of humanitarian aid, and that the funding gets less and less.
Yeah. So it's a very good point. More need, less resources. But the commitment is still there to respond. So we have to change the equation. I started off by saying my first opportunity was to volunteer and to go and support local teams. That's not the model any, you know, in the same way. We'll still deploy staff globally, but in a much smaller and more targeted and tactical way if necessary. The way that we can still effectively address an emergency on the ground is by having a far more localized and community-led response and helping them to organize and prepare. That's the critical thing. We then have to think about increasingly about how we're using technology to make us more efficient and effective. And that's in the early assessments, the data, the communication and the coordination, and the processing of all the information. Often there's a big information overload at the beginning. You're trying to work out where's the most important to go, place to go, and what's actually needed and who's doing what. So I think technology has a big role to play. Then we have to think about how we get assistance. So it's fair to say there's been a lot of research in the last decade on the effectiveness of different ways of, in particular, cash, and what's the most efficient way of helping people directly, if appropriate. But that's not always the best thing to do. So we have to constantly be evolving what is the right offer. Now we're looking at creating and pre-positioning locally supplied care packages, locally put together, locally sourced care packages, which are pre-positioned, again, increasingly with local partners, in order for that to be the first line of response, along with other services and offers.
So the main services one could say, and what people really could imagine how it works, is of course the care package, which is very famous in Austria because we were the top receivers after World War II. Every seventh Austrian has received a care package, many still remembering it. And cash assistance is, you said, where it is appropriate. In any case, it is appropriate in places where disaster hits, where people are used to go shopping, where people are used to do their daily business themselves. Imagine yourself being in an emergency and then you don't have any money left, how you organize your daily life. So the care package might be still existing today in very limited contexts for short time, but places like Syria, where it was normal for people to go to the market, to go to the shops, then of course we are doing cash assistance together with ECHO, and this is the tool of choice.
If there's a market there that people can still access.
Yeah. If there is a market there.
The other thing often we critically do is people need services. Mm-hmm. They need health, they need nutrition support, they need
schooling.
Education is very important, and protection. So often in an emergency, what's happened is the distance from where people have had to move to those services has increased. So another critical thing we can do is bring the services to them. They've already been displaced, they've already had to move, they've already lost their homes, their livelihoods. So often it's very important that we can ensure that they are still able to access all those essential services. And that's where we'll often be working with even local government services, communities, you know, local organization services, but we're enabling those services to be got to where that population is now having to survive.
Which is especially important for women and girls, right? Mm-hmm. Because for them it might be super dangerous also to go to long distance services. It's risky in an emergency setting, not because people are that bad, but because everybody is struggling for survival.
Yeah.
And then nasty things might happen, and especially girls and women have to be protected.
They're definitely the most at risk and the most vulnerable in these contexts. And the sort of, because the community's social fabric and infrastructure is
You have mentioned that new technologies and AI-supported tools will play a bigger and bigger role in the near future. We are already exploring various models. I would say many technological tools are already in place that are helpful to predict when disaster might strike. Is that correct? So this is already there, and not only for care, but this is something that the big organizations and the big global institutions are collaborating on, right?
I think there's a lot of work in trying to predict where the next crisis will hit, but not only how it will hit, and how many will be involved, and what will happen to them. So there's huge potential for that to be explored. I'm not sure anyone's nailed it down just yet in order to complete all our planning, but I think we'll probably see a lot more data being made available, a lot more information being available to help us get better at our planning. Where we really need that is at a local level. Mm-hmm. Large global models are very interesting, but still there's multiple factors that have to be assisted. But if we enable our local actors and partners to get access to those tools, which is feasible now.
Mm-hmm. And which is also a task that care should take care of, right?
And we can help them do that. So that's why in our new strategy, we're highlighting prioritising the role of local community actors doing their own early warning work. They'll often know the signs better than everyone. And then how do they process that information, coordinate with the other actors, and actually take the concrete steps needed when they see the signals that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. So. Would you say that the whole world is in transformational change somehow? Not only organizations like care, but is our whole global society somehow?
It does feel like that. It does feel like that.
Does it feel like that? Is it a matter of age, or do you think?
Yes, it could be. It could be. It's like weariness with the idea that everything is constantly changing. I think we have to accept that we're in a constant state of change, and whether that's economically, politically, socially, due to technology, due to changing ideologies. And certainly we're feeling it a lot in our sector, in terms of, as you mentioned, right, the funding situation, the expectation of organisations, the challenges
and of our
that we're
partners.
Facing, and of our partners, yeah. But on the other hand, when I see our team in a provincial town, in a country, many things stay the same. Their commitment, their resolve, their focus on helping and creating positive change, because change will always happen, but we're about accelerating positive change for those people. And so that commitment's still there.
If we take a more internal look to our organization, so for a leader or a management function, change management somehow always has been a buzzword, hasn't it been? So it's not a positive buzzword. Yes. So how is all this uncertainty shaping your style of leading your teams in care?
Yeah, it's a good challenge, isn't it? There isn't really necessarily one right way of doing it. Your leadership also has to evolve. And we really do need to think about the appropriate leadership in any situation. So inside organisationally, leading externally in different situations with different issues and different teams. You do need to be constantly adapting. I think it's important to remind ourselves of the need for servant leadership. Mm. It's not leadership for our benefit or to serve us. We're here to help make things happen and mobilise, support, and ensure that our teams are, in these circumstances, doing more with less at a time when they're facing extreme pressures themselves and we need them to achieve more than ever before. So it's important to get the basics right in that leadership. We've got to give them something to inspire them. We've got to have clear direction and priorities, but we've also got to make sure they feel like they're part of that process, and that we're co-creating with those teams the success.
So it's an inclusive approach, and of course I have to ask now, what motivates you?
I think we've touched upon it already. I'm still very much, I went from
Helping to change.
but I also, there was a point when I thought in the sector we're only ever as good as the team that we have at that moment. And so it became increasingly important for me to think about how we help teams change themselves. You know, we are about delivering change externally, but internally it's constantly a question of our teams adapting to change, whether they're scaling up a massive response, whether they're closing out a project, whether their country office is expanding, whether they're taking on new types of funding, or it's just a constant question of change. So how do we best support our teams to embrace that change? And then I probably evolved that idea into thinking it's really all about how well we collaborate. If we collaborate well internally to achieve the things we need to, because it's all about cross-team working, then we'll be good at collaborating externally with all the stakeholders, because there's nothing we do that we don't do with a full range of other actors and partners out there. So it helped to change to, it's all about collaboration.
And I think if we are honest, there is nothing more difficult to achieve than change yourself, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
And as leaders who lead their teams through change management, we also have to reflect our own changes within our own personalities, right?
Well, my master's degree was in change, but not change management. It was in working with individuals, groups, and organizations. So it's a very important and a constant process to be reflecting upon how you do things, why you do them, making sure you're aware of that, and trying to make as informed and conscious decisions as much as possible, because we can, under stress and workload and time constraints, it's very easy just to act, you know, in a reactive way.
We have to double check everything.
We have to double check and question everything. So I probably always come back to, am I clear on my intent? Because it's very hard to be, you can't control all outcomes. You never quite know how things will end up.
I think we can control less than we think.
That's right, yeah. Probably ultimately it's more about influencing anything or everything than it's about controlling very much.
Would you say that you're an optimist?
Ah, that's a good question. there was a phrase that said something about being a cynical sentimentalist, but I find it hard to ignore the realities that we face in the world, but that doesn't put me off still wanting to tackle them, still wanting to help organizations be better at what they do, help teams be better at what they do. Because I probably still believe in fighting the good fight. And for me, that good fight is trying to create positive, you know, social impact, social change. So that doesn't waver, even if I'll have those moments where I'm not really sure the world is moving in the direction I'd like it to.
Because I would say one has to be an optimist to do the work that we both have been doing for so many decades. I think these were very interesting insights in the daily work of one of the top leaders of CARE, Ian Vail, a change maker. Thank you for being my guest here at the CARE in Action podcast in CARE Austria. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope that also our audience has enjoyed our conversation. And I'm very convinced that many of you will listen to the CARE in Action podcast also next week. So have a good time. Take care and see you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast by CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For more information about CARE and our projects, visit care.at. There you'll also find out how you can support our work. This podcast is made possible with the generous support of CC Real. Thank you for your commitment, which enables this series of conversations. See you next time.